to the director of the OIG Roundtable and Senior Director for Human Crime Bell, Assistant Special Nicholas Baker. Nicole Field is now not work, not in Dolan, in Wisconsin. And wait, it's clearly in your nobody. So, and it's not because you have the air conditioning. You know, it's because energy is out of control and your heat to curse a body 5 degrees. You're also okay. Yes, and you have some sort of locks over that. Was that that other people in your home are not going and manipulating the temperature to their liking, knowing that your the pillow sharer that you have up until a few years ago had never lived outside of Southern California. So sure. Her thin blood and your thickened blood are certainly are sort of difference. And Matt Kachanski, retired special agent in charge from the OIG, the retired Murphy integrity. He sets his thermostat to 75 because he's not wearing a hoodie and because his wife leads
the
charge.
We followed the example from the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which is burning books and furniture to stay warm.
Well, we burn for different reasons.
Well, yes.
It's very Fahrenheit 451 over at the Chance House. So, to look at ADHD, applied behavioral analysis, becoming a really topic, very hot topic, the Medicaid case, the overall FWA and compliance space. It's a subset of behavioral health. So, for those of you that know the behavioral health space, you know, psychotherapy and medication management and all of this, this is an offshoot. It's becoming a pretty hot topic. Because it's widely covered in the Medicaid space, but it has also become an area that is really both ripe for fraud and rife with fraud. So a lot of it, but also a lot of opportunities for fraud. Part of it is, you know, when you look at ABA therapy, the reason why you have a large Medicaid population is it is really geared towards learning disabled and children with autism. And it's an individualized training program. So there's a plan of care. And then there's daily treatment. And so the documentation flows from that plan of care. And so for those of you in the SIU space conducting investigations involving ABA, when you're making medical record requests, ensure that you get the original document, the plan of care, and then you get each one of those daily visit logs that are out there. I liken it to if any of you are doing investigations involving ancillary services where there's an order for or something like that, your investigation on the MRI, whatever that ancillary service is, but often that results from an order that comes from the referring physician. So you should also be getting from the physician. Yeah, the managers that tell you historically why the patient needs that ultrasound or why they need whatever that item service. It's individualized, it's a service, and it is quickly being seen as the gold standard for that diagnosis, some version of autism, one way or another. And the goal in ABA therapy is to create individualized functionalization for people to be able to operate in social settings and things of that sort, among other things. It's not necessarily a new area, but it is an expanding area. We're seeing a lot of things in the press about autism and obviously arguments for and against the origins of autism and various beliefs. Some of them are conspiracy theories, I think, and others are just scientifically based theories. But at the end of the day, this is a covered service and it is widely reimbursed in the Medicaid space. And so obviously, whenever something becomes a covered service and something has a large amount of recurring revenue, you're going to have opportunities for a lot of FWA in those instances. So You know, Wade, the thing is if you looked back over, you know, your 30 plus years in the industry, AB therapy was probably something you had never heard of. You probably never even thought of ABA outside of the American Bar Association, if you're even familiar with that as an acronym. But, you know, now we have another acronym in our space and back in our space. And this is, you know, to some extent, the argument of becoming. We've talked about Matt says all the time, whenever you're working on a case, you become a subject matter expert on that case you're working on. And, you know, the thing with this is the challenge is that you've got to always keep up with the fraud schemes and the policies and all of that. So talk a little bit, because that becomes a challenge. You're spending your day working on your cases, and then implicit with doing that work and moving your case from the stages to resolution also requires, you know, ongoing education, ongoing review. What are some of the things, and where are some of the places that you've got to start to look at to be able to keep up with all this? Because that landscape changes, it almost seems like daily, right? There's a new policy, there's a new code. And in some instances, wait, right, there are going to be codes where you've got a CPT and a HCPCS code. Same thing, right? We talked before about in the physical therapy space, there's some CPT codes in PT that have companion HCPCS codes. Same recent the policy, actuality, whole thing, the application of codes, all of that. Really, you could spend your whole day doing nothing but reading, researching, and learning.
Right. Yeah, and as you alluded to, I think, you know, oftentimes we talk about these different fraud schemes as being, you know, retro fraud. It's we see the same thing. It's cyclical. You know, this is the same thing we saw in the early 90s or whatever. And this is not that. This is new. This is not retro fraud. We, like you said, we didn't deal with this in the 90 early 90s because it wasn't really a thing. So it's not retro, it's not the same thing, but it is constantly changing. The policies are changing, the coverage issues are changing. So you really do have to can have knowledge and have to like refresh it and update it. It's constantly changing. So you have to look at, you know, different press releases will show you how different schemes are being kind of worked into the system. But even just you know, hitting the, you know, CMS website or whatever for updates and LCDs and NCDs, that type of thing is very important. One of the other things with this type of a fraud that I think is important to kind of point out for SIUs is one of the areas that is, I think, a little bit unique to this is that the medical necessity is definitely an issue in this, and it's either there's a lack of medical necessity or it's ambiguous medical necessity. And that's really not something I know for our SIUs, we don't delve into medical necessity issues. And I think generally SIUs do not. You know, that gets in, this could be a whole topic, but when you start looking at medical necessity issues, it's a expert against expert. You know, you bring up an expert who says it's not medically necessary and they have an expert assessment. Limited in, but other areas in these types of cases, it's like also for services not rendered, you know, inflating different hours, billing for gap time, or what they call nap time. Well, these are all things that we can disprove by reviewing medical records, basically. You know, a lot of it, as we were talking earlier, it's unlicensed or untrained staff, inconsistent documentation, that type of thing. That's all things that we can show historically through record review or just basic research. So we do have to be, you know, there is the one area of medical necessity that's kind of like a, I don't want to say hands off, because you don't want to just give them the green light to bill for things that are not medically necessary, but that's an area that SIUs really have a bit of a difficulty being able to address.
Good point. This premise of necessity, I know we've talked about this a few times on podcasts over the time, which is this premise of that CMS has they widely discuss using, and they use the term medical necessity in the CMS program integrity manual, but it's really at the documentation level. There's very little reference to it from a clinical issue. And I had a case a number of years ago that I worked on here where a law firm asked us to do a review of certain E&Ms, evaluation and management office visits. And the auditor, the provider, had billed them all as level fours and level fives. And our auditor came back and reclassified them as level threes and put in the rationale that the medical necessity didn't exist to show it as a level five. And the lawyer called me up and said, medical necessity. And I said, yes, but we didn't make a clinical decision. Medical necessity is, in this case, is we're not saying that the patient didn't need to go to the doctor. We're not making an argument that the patient did or didn't need to go to the provider. The argument is that the medical decision making, the MDM, didn't support a level five. MDM is documentation related that gets you to that point. So, you know, that's an important piece of it, is that we're not looking at this from that clinical perspective. We're not saying, did the patient need ABA therapy or not, or any other thing that's out there? It's really from that documentation. And that's why having that kind of full spectrum, it is kind of, I feel sometimes that we're working on these cases that help newer teams work, whatever you want to call it, that we spend so much of our time having to learn, like, what is this, right? I remember, like, when we started to see cases involving some things that were not necessarily familiar to us beforehand. And Matt, you'll appreciate this thing about TC cases, talking about skin substitutes and changing policy. But, you know, Wade, before I go to Matt, the thing that always becomes the big issue is the ever evolving analysis of policy. And then we talk about a lot during COVID, the constant changing of either a CPT code or a modifier or coverage policy. You know, when will this be covered? When will this not be covered? And it just seems like every day you are, it's not necessarily an uphill battle, but every day is a constant learning curve in order to really become a true expert in this craft. You really do have to keep up with what the latest and greatest is on what's going on, and understanding that you may have seen a dozen cases with the same CPT codes before and be great at understanding them, but every case is going to have some nuance that makes it new or different or unique. So I think, you know, you do a great job of kind of being in that middle of the road and saying, well, something new, let me kind of just figure it out. And I think the thing is, for a lot of people, it's very easy to get frustrated with, you know, this feeling that it's Groundhog Day, but you really have to look at each case with a fresh eye, because even though you may be familiar with the code, the policy may have changed. COVID is a great example where the policies were so ever-changing. Skin substitutes is now the new one, right? There's some new coverage on that. I haven't even been able to keep up with what the old coverage issues were with skin substitutes, other than how it related back to, you know, end-stage wound care for non-healing ulcers. And there's a whole new body of stuff that's out there. So it's just that it's a constant thing. Which gets back to the next part of the question, or the next part of the discussion, is that you've got to always find your subject matter experts on things, but we're also building the plane while we're flying it and becoming subject matter experts as we do it, coupled with the constant need to provide ongoing training and education for investigators. It doesn't have to be necessarily formal training, but even if there's like a write-up, a monograph, something, coupled with making sure that payment integrity is constantly keeping up to date with the data and the edits. Because if you just rely upon CMS's NCCI, National Correct Coding Initiative, and MUE edits, you're missing a huge portion of what your payment integrity platforms should be doing.
Yeah, ABA especially, the policies, the coverages, the contract language varies by plan, varies by line of business. It is phenomenal. Just a little background on it. There's basically four codes that are used to bill ABA. a technical therapy for, done by a technician can be like a high school graduate, no degrees, anything else. And then there's a professional that supervises it, that builds a separate code. And then there's some family therapy involving either the tech or the professional. And those are the four basic codes. Two of them, the individual ones, build most of the time. What you'll see in the data is, you talked about it, 5 days a week. It can be up to like 11 or 12 hours a day of this therapy. And these are 2 and 3 year old autistic kids. You know, is it possible for them to have even gone through that type of therapy? And it can take place anywhere, the home, the office, school. And school is even the most complex. You know, the kids in school, how much therapy is actually going on? What is the definition of that therapy that's going on? And there's a registry where the non-professionals are supposed to register and get approved to be able to do these services. And that's great, except if you are a commercial patient in New York, there's no such requirement. Joe off the street can be your therapist, and that's approved. So you have to know that policy before you go in. And a chain in the state of Nebraska, where we have a contract, they've got great policies in place, limitations on time per day, all of that stuff, very well laid out. You know, other states that we're dealing with, not so good. You know, so you've really got to get into what is the coverage limits, what is all of those things for this, for this, because it's hundreds of millions of dollars in each state.
Right.
Not saying it's not necessary. I mean, autism is growing. There's so many more people diagnosed with it that need this treatment. Can't argue that. Right. But Medicaid is like the drowning. They're starting to cut back the coverages because of it.
Well, and some of the point, you know, when you see these discussions about why is it that so many people are being diagnosed with autism, well, part of it is that as we evolve medically with things and scientifically with things, our diagnosis skills become better, right? And so we're able to diagnose things better than previously. You're able to diagnose things more accurately, more precisely. So there's some factors there. You know, one of the things you talk about how different states have different policies, and this is actually one of the issues that we run into all the time when we have investigators that are working across different payers in different states. You see that, you know, that we work very hard, obviously, to keep our investigators situated into a plan or to multiple plans in the same state where the policies are going to be generally the same. But, you know, we do talk to people from other firms that do similar work, not as good as us, right? But similar work to us, where people are having to change their, you know, people are having to change their mindset frequently, particularly people that work as auditors. And they work on multiple states. You know, they're working on something for New York now, and in 2 hours they're switching over to another state, and the policies may be entirely different. One of the things that I've started to notice in doing some of my research for us to talk today is that states are trying to align with each other. The states that tend to be more progressive in either cost containment or FWA or something like that, other states are trying to mirror that. I mean, obviously, the fact that in some states you can have, you know, you, me, or Wade showing up to help with some sort of ADA therapy. You know, I had a hard enough time not, you know, accounting for myself. So I couldn't imagine, and I suffer from shiny object syndrome. So I can't imagine that I would be qualified to provide ABA therapy to someone who actually needs it, particularly when some of these therapies are intense, multiple hours a day, and require very patient people to help you train, educate for social skills and things of that sort. So, you know, it's a little bit like we see in the Medicaid space for home health, where the family members can be the provider of the services. And there's a lot of really good positive benefits to that. And I don't ever want to discount that. But obviously the fox watching the hen house, if my grandson or granddaughter caring for me, there's, you know, an inherent question about, you know, are they getting the services, right? I think when you've got unqualified people with a, you know, not to say that a high school education or college or whatever it may be, but you could be a PhD PhD in some skill set, but you've got no qualifications to help with providing, you know, ABA therapy. Yeah. And so I think that is an important piece. That level setting has to occur as well.
Yeah, and going back to Wade's point about the records, you know, because of these four different codes, when you're asking for the records, you get the plan of care. If there is a referral, get the referral. Sometimes these cases are referred by the state or a board. There's not really an individual that refers it, so there's some differences there. Get the different records for the technical therapy and the supervisory therapy. Things should be different. And the supervisory therapy, one of the, if you read the code, it talks about they have to be able to examine and see if there are any changes needed in the therapy regimen. And that's got to be documented in the supervisor notes. So those things need to be looked at. The codes themselves, you talked about edits. You know, we were working a case for one of the clients where the code that they were using for these services was a HCPCS code that was terminated years ago. But many providers were still using it. And we were opening these cases on that. Comes to find out, they're getting pre-auths to use that code. So the plan itself was not abiding by its own edits and coverage and policies.
It's crazy. And, you know, so I've noticed, you know, one of the things that I do here is I do a lot of expert reporting on personal injury cases, on calculating costs of care, and it's not worth getting into the nuts and bolts of it, but states have different requirements as to what you have to do, from outstanding bills. We do a lot of the back end payer reset. And I see frequently we have bills that come from providers from these personal injury cases where they're using a code that's been sunset. It's not even a usable CPT or a HCPCS code anymore. And, you know, one of the things that we do is we have the auditors go and find, for example, you know, we find these codes that are these cumulative codes that aren't separately reimbursed. And then we have to figure out what would the likely series of codes be and all of that. But, you know, it even filters down. The point I'm making is providers sometimes aren't able to keep up with things, and it's directly affecting their revenue cycle. And you would hope that the providers have at least somebody in their office doing the billing and coding, and that their software is up to date. So you see that in the live commercial space as well, where there's CPT codes, HCPCS codes that have been outdated, sunset. I mean, I have a project I worked on recently where the code that they used was sunset in like 2021, and it's 5 years later and they were putting it on a claim. Now, part of that is they know they're not getting paid by an insurance company because it's a personal injury case. The method of payment is a little bit different. There may be some what they call Medicare secondary payer, MSP issues involved or something like that. But the bills are usually treated a lot differently in personal injury cases. There are what they call letters of protection, and there's a whole different methodology on how those are paid. So I think at the end of the day, the provider cares less about the code that he or she are using, because ultimately it's whatever that negotiated dollar amount is that they're calling usual and customary, which is never usual and is never customary. But, you know, that's part of that argument. So Wade, I give you the last dibs on this one, because that becomes the thing. It's, you know, we get so used to seeing some codes, and then there are codes that we just don't see because you can't be omnipotent, right? I had a conversation with someone the other day. The CPT book is this big. The HCPCS book is this big. Impossible to know every code. You become familiar with the ones in your specialties, but this is one of those where, you know, you've got to, when you see a code that you're not familiar with, you've got to start going on and doing some research on what is the reimbursement for that code, what does it look like. And so I think, you know, the takeaway, and tell me what the thoughts are, is you've got to always be curious, right? Curiosity doesn't kill the cat in fraud, waste, abuse investigations.
Right. And recently we had on one of the contracts that I worked with Matt, we had somebody running claims data and basically mining for these claims that are no longer still supposed to be used. You know, I think some of them actually in the description, it says, you know, do not use this code or something to that effect. So we ran a bunch of data and we came up with all these claims where they were billing for claims that were sunsetted or should not be used anymore. And I think in those cases, in most of those cases, it wasn't like an intentional fraud situation. They didn't really gain anything by billing these. It was not keeping up on the current changes and updates and things of that nature. And in those cases, you're not probably going to have like a full overpayment where, you know, it was 1,000 claims billed incorrectly. So that's all needs to be paid back to the plan. It's probably more like it was just the wrong code. They should have been paid something, just not that. And in most cases, it's going to be less, but it could be where they could have been getting more money too. But the bottom line is it was probably more of an error. And not only for the SIUs to keep up on the updated codes and what's still right. billable, is for the providers as well, because you could right. be, they could be missing out on a lot of money that they're due.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, like, while I think most of the people that tune into our podcast are on the payer side and people that are more on the investigative side, you know, I do know that we do have people that tune in once in a while that are on the provider side. And this is a great example, like, you know, from the provider perspective, like, if you have claims that are being denied, understand what is the RCA, root cause analysis. Why is that claim being denied, particularly if it's being denied just on the submission of the claim itself, because human eyes don't look at a claim anymore. And so if you have claims that are being denied, you've got to understand that from a revenue cycle. And this is where, when we talk about in statistically valid random sampling, the inclusion of zero paid claims, because there is a legitimate argument. There is some movement and some case law out there. And there's a great lawyer that does a lot of the work in fighting with these on SBRSs, where the argument is that you need to include a zero pay claim because that might actually be a reason. Maybe you used an inaccurate CPT code when you should have used a HCPCS code or something, where you really can get paid for a claim, but you just made the error in the wrong CPT code that didn't match the other data. So it's a great point. And it's from a revenue cycle perspective, like, you should get paid for the things you actually do that are proper. And that's obviously one of the things to look at. So good stuff. I mean, ABA Therapy, we're doing a ton. We have an entire team of auditors on a prepay contract where they're doing the bulk of the work they're doing is ABA in the Medicaid space. And I could tell you that our SIU partner is seeing an ROI that is somewhere in the 5-to-1 range, which is very high, particularly in Medicaid. And so we're seeing these returns based upon some of the FWA issues that are out there. So ABA is a big thing. And the challenge is that your auditors have to become conversant in some of the nuances. And that's where I think it's very important to know it all float. Don't think of it in a vacuum. Think of ABA as an ancillary service, similar to other things, where plan of care flows down to the individual dates of service, 360 degrees. Auditors look at 360 degrees of the claim and 360 degrees of the pattern of the claim, and that's the historical piece. So you've got to look at those pieces of the puzzle to get the full picture. So it's interesting. It's a topic that continues to grow. We're seeing cases that are coming out from ABA, and obviously we didn't get a chance to really talk about it, but a lot of the ABA organizations out there are private equity backed. And as we have seen from other cases in the emergency department setting, we've seen private equity involved in a lot of those cases. And we see a lot of civil lawsuits. We've seen a lot of cases coming in because it's obviously about a return on investment from the provider side on that. So I think we're going to see a lot more of these cases. I know that there have been some work plan items from the OIG on analysis of ABA in different states. So I think we're going to see some additional cases come out in the near future. I know we're getting asked all the time about audits and investigations involving ABA. So it's not something that's going away. It's, I think, one of these developing emerging fraud schemes, as they like to say. So keep your finger on the pulse of it. Keep doing the research. Use these new cases as opportunities to learn and grow and become expert in things. You become an expert when something new occurs and you spend the actual time to do the research and learn about the regulations and the policies and that kind of thing. To be successful, I think, as an investigator, no matter what you're doing, it's thirst for knowledge. And curiosity is a good thing. So keep it up, everybody. And as always, we appreciate you taking the time to talk and to meet with us. Hopefully, you're on the back end of winter, only a few more weeks left. So that's what the groundhog said at Punxsutawney. Although I will say Staten Island Chuck had a different view. I think he had 4 weeks. It was not the same as Punxsutawney Phil. So either way, bend at the knees when shoveling. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. We like to give a lot of information here, even if it's not relevant to healthcare. See you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.